My son Robin is preaching in Toronto, Canada, this morning. So Sean and Blue are present, and they are warmly welcome. Tom and Susan Robb are visiting Sue Spriggs, and they are also warmly welcome. Please say hello to them and our other visitors when the service is over. I have just finished the most exciting book I have ever read about one of my favorite topics, the origin of the universe and what its future may be. It's more than a hobby, this fascination with the stars. It's a natural outgrowth of a lifelong interest in religion. The Hebrew poet who wrote the 8th Psalm had looked with wonder into the night sky. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. When I look at thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast established, what is man that thou art mindful of him? I've wondered the same many times. And if 3 professions had been possible in one lifetime, I would also have liked being an astronomer. So someone saw me reading this book called Thursday's Universe and said, partly to make conversation, but also with an undertone of seriousness, well, what do you think? Are we alone? The question hung in the air between us for a long moment while we both reflected on how many times it has been asked since the first human being looked from some cave mouth or campfire into the starry darkness and wondered why she existed and whether out there someone or something else might also exist. Meteors, after all, flashed across the sky. Planets moved. Ancient sky watchers could hardly be blamed for thinking there must be some kind of life in that unreachable world above them. We still wonder, and we listen with great dish-shaped antennae and sophisticated recording technology for some kind of signal that intelligent life lives somewhere in our universe. But so far, we have no positive response. If we were to get one, it would be the biggest story in the history of humanity. Proof that we are not alone, irresistible incentive to try to make contact. I suppose one reason I could not put such thoughts out of my mind this past week was that we had, a few hours ago, a cosmic probe out in the eternal night about 4 billion miles away from us, taking close-up pictures of Neptune, the icy, cold planet with that one strange moon that goes in the wrong direction around it. Our Voyager space probe is a stunning achievement of modern science. But I mention it mainly as a way of reminding you of the high romance that pops up occasionally from the dedicated lives of people who study the sky, and also as a way of reminding you that we have already become blasé about the space age. When television commemorated the moon landing a few weeks ago, it was fascinating to see the old shots again and learn some new facts about how close we came to tragedy, to leaving two brave men stranded forever on the moon's dry dust. And then there was that unforgettable picture, which hangs in my office, the first vision we ever had in all our history of how the Earth itself actually looks from space. That incredible image of a milky sapphire hanging alone and fragile in the darkness. Moonrise and sunrise we have known forever. But I have never gotten over the excitement I felt when I first saw that picture of an Earthrise shot from the moon and provoking what astronaut Edgar Mitchell called, in a marvelous phrase, instant global consciousness. Think about it for a moment. Instant global consciousness. The sudden taking in of the planet Earth as a single entity, seeing it all at once, and feeling as one had never been able to feel before, the interdependency of all its life. I am not the same man, one astronaut said when it was over. None of us are. I can understand that. I remember the extraordinary impact on American life when millions of World War II soldiers were exposed to cultures they had never known before and came home with a whole new outlook on the world. And now, still in their lifetime, others have gone out and looked back at the whole Earth from the moon and seen what no person had ever seen before. Not Europe or Asia, but the whole world hanging there, a kind of spaceship itself hurtling through the night. A new metaphor for this age, spacecraft Earth. Population several billion, flight plan uncertain, crew restless, but needing one another and closer to one another than any of us had ever imagined. And seeing the planet Earth like one of those agate marbles we used to shoot on school playgrounds a long time ago, the question rose again with fresh insistence, are we alone? Let's back up a bit to see how we even came to ask the question, because it was hardly a viable question through most of our history. We have had to make several adjustments in our thinking about the universe. First of all, we were geocentric, centered upon the Earth. The sun and moon and stars all existed for us. God made the sun to give light by day and the moon to give light by night. The fact that the moon does not show at all for 1 week each month and is only at half power for two more did not give the ancient author of Genesis a moment's pause. He was not writing science. He was writing a theology in which God is responsible for everything, and his medium is poetry and not mathematics. For thousands of years, in the mythologies of different countries, humanity was the apple of some god's eye, the center of the universe, the reason everything else existed. But by the 16th century, because of a man named Copernicus, thoughtful people had to give up the Earth-centered theory in favor of a world centered around the sun. Most people resisted. It was not gratifying to the ego to be told that our beloved Earth was just one in a whole family of planets circling around the sun. So we scoffed at the idea, made fun of those who begged us to look through a telescope, and persecuted some of them as heretics against true religion. But the forward march of truth is only delayed, not stopped. And after a while, we had to accept the notion that instead of being the most important object in the sky, we were one of the smaller planets circling endlessly around the sun. It wasn't a totally devastating idea. After all, the sun, we had learned, is the source of all life on Earth. Warm red in the first hour of morning, immense and golden as it drops behind a mountain or into the sea. It was probably a good thing that we did not know then that it is a turbulent ball of gas with awesome explosions of energy, erupting sunspots, and solar winds flaming out thousands of miles into space, not always a friendly host. But much more recently, we had to make still another adjustment. And this one was so disturbing that a great many people somehow managed not to think about it at all. They may read about it briefly somewhere, but it does not register. It has no emotional impact. It does not change thought. I refer to the realization that our sun, far from being the center of the universe, is a very ordinary star out at the far edge of a single huge galaxy of millions of similar stars. We live in the galaxy called the Milky Way. Mathematically, it must have hundreds of thousands, even millions, of planetary systems like the one we know. That is staggering enough, but there is more. Our galaxy is only one of an uncountable number of galaxies in the immensities of space. Now think of where we've been. We find out that we are one of several planets orbiting the sun, and not even the biggest. Then we find out that our sun is a minor star among millions of stars in the galaxy to which it belongs. And then we find out that our galaxy, which has already staggered our imaginations, is only one of millions of galaxies. Can you imagine how the old psalmist would say it now, knowing what we know? When I look up at the stars, O God, what is our small planet that you should be concerned with it? So now, feeling more lonely by far than our ancestors felt, we ask the old question with new intensity: are we alone? When I was a child, we wondered if there might be life on Mars or Venus. I read every single one of the old Edgar Rice Burroughs books. And I can remember, as if it were only yesterday, that I read about a man named John Carter standing on the lip of a cave in New Mexico or Arizona, reaching out his arms yearningly toward the red planet Mars, and then all of a sudden feeling himself drawn at incredible speed through space until he stood on the surface of the planet surrounded by living creatures. I tried it for several nights, myself, arms outstretched, trying to will myself to Mars, probably with the silent encouragement of my parents, but nothing happened. Well, we no longer dream of neighbors on Mars or Venus or Saturn, of course, because we've sent probes to photograph those places, and life as we know it appears completely impossible on those planets. Too close to the sun, burning up, too far from it, freezing cold, lacking one or more of several essential ingredients of familiar life. But now, we know of hundreds of millions of stars, suns, any one of which could have a planetary system to which it could give light and warmth. And so we wonder again. Mathematically, it seems certain that somewhere in the mind-boggling immensities of space, circling those billions of stars, there have to be planets that get the right amount of energy for the complex biological activity we call life. The astronomers, I read, are confident that given the huge number of solar systems likely in the universe, the right climate must exist in some of them for the basic building blocks of life. If there is life, then evolution must have taken place as millenniums passed. It is even possible, they think, that our intelligence may have been surpassed on one of those inconceivably remote and invisible worlds. But, and please remember this part, they are not suggesting that we have been repeated. They are convinced that we have traveled a long and unbelievably complicated road on the way to becoming human by a process that made a million turns and false starts, ran into blind alleys, branched off, turned back, went off again obliquely, so that for them, we are the unique end product of a process that mathematically is not likely to happen again anywhere else in the universe. Life somewhere, but not the same, once it develops beyond the simplest form. Is there life on other worlds? I think the answer to that is almost certainly. Are we alone? Homo sapiens? That amazing form of life sitting next to you? Well, my answer to that would be, I think we are. I doubt that life like ours, with vermiform appendixes and tonsils and wisdom teeth, has ever shown itself anywhere else. I would love to be wrong. And since proof is probably far beyond our lifetime, if it ever comes, you can believe whatever you like. But what seems most likely to be true is that we have each other and the mystery we call God, and the life that went by the name of Jesus, so radiant that we called him Son of God. And we have a legacy of laws about how to deal with the kind of life we have. And beyond us, in every direction, there stretches an immensity which overwhelms us and which ought to make us treasure one another and cherish this blue and white planet that swings on its lonely circle through the everlasting night and make us want to take care of one another and take care of it. We haven't done either of those very well. So we need to hear again the words of Archibald MacLeish, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, responding in 1969 to that famous image of the Earth rising over the moon. Listen, because no one has said it better. The medieval notion of the Earth put man at the center of everything. The nuclear notion of the Earth, he was very upset about nuclear weapons. The nuclear notion of the Earth put him nowhere, beyond the range of reason even, lost in absurdity and war. This latest notion, having seen the Earth from out in space, may have, he says, other consequences. Formed as it was in the minds of heroic voyagers who were also men, it may remake our image of mankind. No longer that preposterous figure at the center, no longer that degraded and degrading victim off at the margins of reality and blind with blood, man may at last become himself. And then his magnificent closing paragraph, which I want you to walk out of this room remembering, to see the Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the Earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who know now they are truly brothers.